Ladies and gentlemen, break the knobs off your radios, shut off your televisions, but turn up the volume on your smartphones and MP3 players. For the next 30 minutes, you will experience a blackout. Welcome to the show that gives you news commentary from a black male perspective. Do you know what time it is?
Yes, it is. It is Dr. Vibe here, host and producer of Do You Know What Time It Is, which is on most Sunday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, where a panel of black men give their thoughts, comments, and whatever else they want to put in to current events and news stories. I am, again, Dr. Vibe, host and award-winning host of the and producer of the Dr. Vibe show. Also, I'm in the CEO and president of Express Your Vibe Coaching and Communications. As always, I like to say you're blessed, highly favored, a magnet for miracles and a solution for someone's problem, and very happy if you've taken time to listen to the conversation live or listen to it on rebroadcasts. It's appreciated and not taken for granted. We have three panelists this evening, and one is a gentleman who we have not heard from for a bit because he has been positive productive. He has been busy. He's been positive productive. I've had the honor and pleasure of knowing this gentleman for a few years now, and he is one of the beacons and one of the tip of the spears when it comes to Philadelphia and sharing what's going on in Philadelphia with Philadelphia around the world. We have Christopher Flood, the drummer Norris, on our panel tonight. Chris, what's going on?
Well, thank you for having me back, sir. It has been a long time, and I am happy to be here.
Excellent. What have you been up to over the last few months? There's been a lot of things going on in your world.
Yeah, well, I mean, other than every day producing original stories of impact, issue, inspiration, and innovation for multiple platforms, including the Goodman Project and Comcast's Philly in Focus, I have been substituting at 900 AM WURD, Pennsylvania's only black talk radio station, for the drive time host there, Mr. Nick Taliaferro. And so for every day, for about 3 weeks, I was hosting the 4 to 7 p.m. Live news hour, producing the show, I should say programming the shows, getting the talent, developing the questions and the format, arranging the music. I was also working on an investigative story for Philadelphia Magazine on the problems with an emerging HIV prevention pill. And most recently, my company, Technical Online, has become an Apple News publisher. So that means the consumers, the 1 billion consumers with iPhones, can access our quality journalism simply by adding Techbook Online to their Apple News reader.
Congratulations. That is fantastic on all the stuff that you have been doing. You and Techbook Online and the members of Techbook Online, congratulations on your continuing success and continuing to move forward in the right direction when it comes to content providing and also sharing the message and making the message count.
Well, I appreciate that, sir. And though it has been a quite adventure summer thus far, there's nothing like the Dr. Vibe show. This is an experience all on its own. So I'm glad to be here.
Well, that's fantastic. We're just going to get one of our panelists back on the call. He dropped off, so we're just going to call him right now and get him back on. Hello, Ron. You are back, and it's your turn to introduce yourself, so go for it.
Okay, my name is LaRon Barton. I'm a writer, author of two books. The first one is Straight Dope, a 360-degree look into American drug culture. My second and latest book is All We Really Need Is Love, Stories of Dating, Heartbreak, Relationship, and Marriage. I'm a writer of essays that talk about race, mass incarceration, gender, sexuality, and dating. My latest piece is called Using Uber While Black, and it is on goodmenproject.com. And always, Dr. Bob, I'm truly honored and humbled to be a part of this panel and love to express my thoughts with other fellow more intelligent black men. So, thank you.
Excellent. Fantastic. Next up, we have from the South, from Atlanta, where it's seemed to have cooled down a little bit. We've got the fatherpreneur, Rodney Kellum.
Hello, Dr. VIBE. This is Rodney Kellum. I always like to start by saying thank you to Dr. Vibe for providing an outlet for black men to talk about things that matter to us and those that love us. I've been doing a whole lot of driving, a whole lot of parenting, a whole lot of living, and it's a joy to be on here to talk about a few issues that I know will bring out the passion in the panelists tonight. So, ready to roll.
Excellent. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for taking the time out of your positive, productive schedule. So let's get right to it. First conversation piece tonight, why Donald Trump supporters think he will win. And Donald Trump has had a little bit of a tough week, especially with some of the things that is going on with his campaign, with people saying that, you know, no fellow like high-ranking Republicans are supporting him. Then the whole issue between him and the father of the Muslim soldier that was killed in battle. So it's been quite a week for Donald Trump. So let's have your guys' takes on it. And why do you think he still has a chance to win? So first up on this, Flood the Drummer.
I actually don't think his supporters think he's going to win. Maybe they did in the primaries. I think that their hope is diminishing day by day. I think his supporters want him to win, and wanting someone to win and thinking they will are two different things. I think particularly this week that he just had would have extinguished any level of excitement or potential that was present. I think the conversation that has emerged from the political and punditry class about Donald Trump's mental health is damaging. It's also really relevant. I wrote a piece last week called, or about 2 weeks ago, called The Demented Donald Trump and His Hype and Hypocrisy. I truly believe Donald Trump is demented. He shows all the signs of someone who is demented. I mean, beyond being a narcissist, beyond being a xenophobe or sexist or racist, he is mentally ill. And it's unfortunate that in America, we don't know how to address or acknowledge mental illness in the proper way. We clearly cannot acknowledge or won't acknowledge in a meaningful way that Donald Trump is having some sort of meltdown in front of the public. This is not the way a 70-year-old man is supposed to act. I mean, the standard has been lowered for him so dramatically that when he behaves or stays on messaging for one day, people are celebrating it. His surrogates are getting on the staff and saying, oh, no, Trump had a great day. He stayed on message. And the fact that you have to laud an adult for behaving in public, it's absurd. I mean, this entire thing defies logic. And every day that I see Trump on the TV, I just kind of look at this and I go, how is this happening? You know, I mean, what is happening? But the good news is, and winding up, I think that the media has turned on Trump. I think if you watch people like Joy Ann Reid and others, you know, they're shutting down his supporters and not letting them, you know, just go on and on with their conspiracy theories like they were in the primaries. And last thing I'll say is Trump has almost 0% of the black vote anywhere. And I think that it is almost impossible for any person to win the presidency of the United States without the black vote. And since he is not actively trying to obtain it, since he has proven that the black vote doesn't matter to him, to me, that means that he's either trying to sabotage his campaign by not going after an extremely powerful and influential constituency, or he really is racist.
Okay, next conversation will come from LaRon.
You know, Dr. Vibe, I really like this article. I like the way that it was written. I mean, it just felt like that these were straight from the mouths of the uninformed and the delusional. I do disagree with our new friends from Philly, because I do think that Donald Trump is going to win, and I don't think that he's mental at all. I mean, I think that people, just reading that piece, man, people don't want a politician that's been in the system for years and years and years. People don't want someone that is just sort of double talking and it's just going to talk in circles around a certain subject. People want somebody who is a business person, someone who is an outsider, someone who cannot be bought. and someone who's not on the payroll of all the Wall Street bankers. And I mean, just someone who's a rebel, man. I mean, and that's everything that Trump represents. You know, one of the, I can't get this out of my mind, man, but like one of the people in the piece said that, you know, you remember when you were coming up and everything was okay. You know, you were living in your parents' world. You know, you were living in a white world, and it's, you know, and it's time for us to, you know, take back the country and how men, we need to show that leadership is a male quality. And I mean, and it's ridiculous, but it's the way people think. You know, I think Trump has really tapped into how the majority of whites feel in America. You know, they may not be as overtly racist as Trump is, but there's something about, you know, kind of getting things back to the way they are. You know, whenever you hear, let's make America great again, that just essentially means, hey, let's take America back to the 50s and to the 40s, where it was just primarily white. And it's just all about, you know, whites have this overwhelmingly advantage over everyone. Not that they don't, because they still do. But, you know, you didn't see Negroes on TV other than to, you know, step and fetch it and to sing songs. You know, I mean, people that are voting for him feel left out. People that are going to vote for Donald Trump feel like that their America slipping away from them. And you have a guy who's so overtly racist, right? And, you know, and again, man, I don't think he's mentally ill. I think he's saying what a lot of people have been feeling for a really long, long time. And I just feel like that people are just like, man, you know, here's a candidate that's honest. I mean, if you look at Donald Trump's opponent, Hillary Clinton, she is arguably one of the most dishonest and just shady and crooked and just unpure candidates we've seen in quite some time. I mean, she flip-flops on everything, where you have a guy like Trump who's pretty consistent. I mean, as a black person, there's no way in hell that absolutely. Like, as a black person, there's no way in hell that I would ever vote for Donald Trump. But with Hillary Clinton, man, I mean, she's flip-flopped from the LGBTQ, from the TPP. I'm sorry, did I put too many P's on it? The Trans-Pacific Partnership. She's flip-flopped on the Iraq War. She's flip-flopped on the 1994 crime bill. I mean, there's so many inconsistencies with her. So, you know, you have to appreciate someone that is just going to flat out tell you, listen, you know, you are an N, versus someone who's going to go around and say, oh, well, you know, you guys are super predators. And I don't know about you, man, but I prefer my racism flat out in my face rather than just sort of like low key sneaky. So, and I'm telling you, man, I'm like,
okay, hold up, Chris. I'll give you a moment to respond to that after Rodney speaks. Rodney.
Okay. So I've been saying this from the beginning. Donald Trump is putting on one heck of a performance as an actor. And I agree more with LaRon to believe that he's not mentally ill for the specific fact that I would believe he was mentally ill if we had never seen this in history before. The sad truth is we have seen exactly what Donald Trump is doing in history from a guy named Adolf Hitler. And I mean, I've said it every time we've talked about Donald Trump. It's as if Donald Trump and his handlers took the Adolf Hitler handbook on how to run a successful political campaign and are running it to a T. And I'm going to give you evidence in this article. One of the persons being interviewed in it said this: Donald energized his voters, people who are ding, 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 afraid of ding, 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 crime, and ding, 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 worried about the mass immigration that's transforming their country and ding, 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 displacing them. What he's doing is playing on fear. Now, I've said this from the beginning. I truly believe I'm still baffled that Donald Trump won the Republican nomination, but I truly believe he still won't become president because of things like this. Now, the question was why Trump supporters think he'll win is that the true diehard Trump supporters operate on fear. Now, if by some reason Donald Trump does become president, it's because this tactic gets enough fuel to fuel the fears of the masses, meaning more terroristic attacks, meaning things that will shine Donald Trump as the only person who can keep us safe from these horrible atrocities and these brown-skinned immigrants that are taking over our jobs and our communities. The same thing happened with Bush on the second term. People that may have voted for his opponent voted for Bush because they were afraid the Iraq war was still going on. They're still searching for Osama bin Laden. So we have to look at history and look at who said the exact same thing. Hitler was not a wonderful orator. Hitler was not the smartest person, the smartest cookie, you know, cookie in the bag. However, he actually got speech lessons from a well-renowned speech coach who is Jewish. He learned how to speak with emotion. So every speech you see of Adolf Hitler is and when you see Donald Trump, you see that same, you know, we're going to build a wall, and it's going to be great. He's not saying anything specific or plans, but he's playing on emotion. The man has yet to provide any plans or strategies, but people are still diehard about him. And it's because of the same kind of people in Germany that allowed the Nazi Party to come to power. And I know that's controversial to say that in America's society and this post-racial society that this could be possible. Well, this might surprise you, but history has a tendency to repeat itself if you do not educate yourself. And most people do not take the time to look at the tragedies in human history and realize it can be you as well. And right now, there's a group of people that are more than willing to be on the wrong side of history because of fear, ignorance, hatred, prejudice, white supremacist racism, misinformed, whatever you want to call it. But that's who his supporters, true supporters, are. The Republican Party is wavering like a mug right now, but those diehard people that are scared, oh, they're up in arms. They're the ones ready to defend him. They're the ones being hypocritical to a fault for the purpose of their supporting the person that they believe will keep them safe. And their ideals are horrible. Their thought process is ridiculous, but they have the right to vote. And unless, you know, fearful things keep happening, Hillary will win. Unless people wake up and say, no, you know what, we don't have to vote Republican and Democrat. There is a third party candidate. Maybe we're going to show these two parties, you know, what we truly believe and make them change and vote for, I think it's the Libertarian Party. There's another party involved. But people have power. You have to stop letting media and all these entities shape your thinking into thinking you only have two choices. You only have to do things this way. You're a free-thinking human being. Use your brain.
All right, gentlemen. Sounds like you're having a calm first conversation. So I'm just going to continue on. Chris, I'll give you 45 seconds to add on because it sounded like you had something to say. So you got 45.
Well, I'll just say real quick that, you know, the statement about Trump being mentally ill is not my opinion. He shows the symptoms of someone who's demented. And demented means driven to behave irrationally due to anger, distress, or excitement. That completely explains how he's engaged with the cons, how he's engaged with Megyn Kelly, how he attacked anyone who comes at him who he feels slighted by. Elizabeth Warren calling her Pocahontas. Anytime he's angry or excited, he behaves irrationally. That is the context, textbook definition of someone who's demented. So it's not my opinion. That's his behavior. The second thing is both your guests refuted the idea that he's mentally ill but didn't actually provide any proof why he isn't, other than to say, well, you know, he's just doing what Hitler did for his message is resonating. Simply because his message is resonating or because his behavior is mirroring someone who came before him doesn't have any context on his mental illness. It means that he's just doing something that he's seen done. The last thing, I think it was disingenuous for LaRon to say that Donald Trump has been consistent. He has not been consistent in anything since he started his campaign, particularly lately on his relationship with Putin. First, he had a great relationship with Putin. Now he doesn't even know who Putin is, wouldn't be able to recognize him if he was in a room. He started his campaign off saying he's going to get 100% of the black vote, and now we're in a general election, and he's got 0%, and they're not making any overtures toward it. He has flip-flopped on everything from his opinion to the war in Iraq to writing he's seen terrorists celebrating after 9/11. So he's not consistent. He's not in his right mind to be health, and healthy, and he's not going to be the president of the United States.
All right, I'm going to move on because I think we'll need to do that on another conversation. I can hear LaRon sigh, so we're going to on because we could take the whole conversation on that. We're going to leave it. I was doing that because Chris has not been on for a while, so I gave him the levity to do that. Next conversation piece. Sports stars, leagues, and owners can lead next-level change, and this is a little bit based on a few months ago. If anyone knows the cable sports network, ESPN has an annual award show called the ESPYs, and a number of significant athletes from the NBA gave statements on how we can move forward, how can America move forward in regards to police and race and racism in general. So we'll start the conversation off with LaRon.
You know, when I saw the Chris Paul, LeBron James, Carmelo Anthony, and Dwayne Wade give their speech at the ESPYs, I was like, I mean, it's almost like it's trendy now, you know? I mean, it's one of those moments where, you know, you can be safe, you know, you don't have to go out on a limb and say anything because, again, I mean, it's the thing to do. You know, if you were really trying to be brave, Chris Paul, then you would have talked to your fellow teammates and boycotted the playoff series that the LA Clippers were in when the former owner Donald Sterling was caught on tape saying racist things. But that's besides the point. You know, I'm happy that athletes are starting to wake up and starting to say things. I mean, but I don't know, you guys. I'm kind of indifferent to it because, I mean, none of the athletes are really speaking to the real problem, which is police terrorism and it's racism, white supremacy. It's like whenever we talk about those issues, they have to say, oh, well, you know, we need to stop police brutality, but we also need to recognize that police are putting their lives on the line. And we also need to address black and black crime. And it's never this one singular thing. It's always like, okay, well, yeah, let me address the issue, but let me pad it with all these other things. And I mean, these guys, they aren't like Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, Bill Russell. I mean, they're not even like a young Lew Alcindor who was not even in the NBA. But at the same time, times have changed. Man, I mean, men are making multi-million dollars. And a lot of these guys, I mean, when they come through the collegiate level, even when they're playing in these hostile environments, some of their coaches will tell them, listen, do not respond to any of these racial slurs. We're not going to talk about it. All you need to do is just play basketball. So these guys have been conditioned to not even respond to any of the racial incidents that have been going on. A lot of these guys are just simply insulated. So now with all of these instances of police terrorism going on and on and on, now it's like it's chic to be somewhat of an activist. And you know what, man? Hey, you know, saying something is better than saying nothing. But I just feel like that, you know, if you're going to do it all the way. You know, don't half step. You know, I mean, it's just like Michael Jordan, right? You know, and Michael Jordan's my favorite athlete of all time, straight up. But Michael Jordan gave $1 million to the NAACP or an organization affiliated with that. And he also gave a police organization $1 million. Now, that's almost like you're playing both sides of the fence. So I don't know about you guys, but where I come from, there's no fence riding in the hood. You know, you either are or you ain't. And people need to start taking real stands. You know, one athlete that I really admire is Marshawn Lynch because he's really taking a stand. He's not like Richard Sherman that's saying, well, yeah, you know, Black Lives Matter, but what about black on black crime? And just, you know, I mean, Sherman's a victim. I understand that, but that's kind of soft shoe cooing. So I just think that if we're going to do something, let's do it all the way and let's not half step.
Rodney.
So I would like to add two things. I didn't know Charles Grantham has had such an impact on the NBA Players Association, going all the way back to the Mandela anti-apartheid movement. So maybe I gained a little more respect for that man. Secondly, I would like to point out something that made what these four men did on ESPN possible. And we have to give credit where credit is due. And that is to the WNBA players. The WNBA players that make significantly less money and risked their paycheck. They risked, you know, getting suspended or fined, which they did, in order to make a statement about Black Lives Mattering. And there was white players that joined in with them. And because of them, Carmelo was the one really championing what they did. And I think that was a catalyst for this moment on stage. Now, what I will say is that I would say this clarion call needs to continue to be trumpeted, because if you think about it, right now these men are more free in the ability to do things like this. If you think about the era of the Jim Browns and the Lew Alcindors, who became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and you think about the Muhammad Alis, they literally lost careers. They lost millions of dollars for the purpose and the betterment of our people. At this point, the LeBrons and the Dwayne Wade don't really stand to lose much of anything by speaking up, because they do it in such a safe way. They do it in such a guarded way, and they built up their player resume in a way that, you know, and also the laws are in place such a way that if the league were to try and take away the careers, it would ruin the league. Back when Muhammad Ali was stripped of his boxing license, it didn't ruin boxing, because most people didn't feel the way Muhammad Ali felt. And the black community didn't pull their dollars enough to say, hey, don't you do this to our hero. That man paid the price for 3 years of his career, prime years of his career. Right? Now, these men aren't risking that. WNBA players, they were risking that. And so this needs to continue. When you have a league that's 80% black, you would think 50% of those players could at least agree on, let's stand together on this, because there's power in numbers. I think this is the time for the NFL players, the NBA players, and those black Dominicans in the MLB to come. Yes, I said that. That's controversial. I know. They don't know they're black, but they are. To come together and say, sports players from all the major sports, because I don't know how many are in hockey, and say, we stand together. And our money machine will put you to a halt if you don't take a stance that's in favor of us. That's what happened during the anti-apartheid movement. Students from colleges and HBCUs all around this country posed boycotts, where companies like Coca-Cola that were funding these apartheid companies, you know, they were the money talks, and they control enough of it to make a change. It's time to do it.
Flood the drummer.
So I like the article because it was idealistic. I think the one thing that was missing from it, though, was to talk about the incentive. And we don't often talk about incentive structures when we talk about theory of change and social change. What is the incentive for the NBA as a whole, as an institution, to leverage its assets, to leverage its influence for this issue? Appealing simply to their moral compass has proven not to be effective. As Roddy said, money talks. And I don't think, you know, an article didn't lay out what would be the incentive of the NBA. And I don't think we thought about that. I don't think we think about that when we say, you know, why don't these more celebrities get involved? You know, I always say, what's the incentive for them to get involved? Look at Bow Wow. I mean, he came out with a statement saying he's mixed. He doesn't feel like he needs to vote. He doesn't feel the struggle for the civil rights movement as he did, because he doesn't see himself as black. He doesn't have an incentive to leverage his social capital for this issue. And so I think it's about trying to find an incentive issue. For example, police misconduct, police brutality, officer-involved shooting, those things cost bad officers cost cities a lot of money every year, and settlements and arbitration And so you might not be able to appeal to a CEO by simply saying, hey, Black Lives Matter, or hey, you know, this is happening from a social justice angle. But appealing to them from an incentive structure, hey, you know, you're interested in a city that's fiscally conservative. How do you feel about, you know, 10% of the city's operating income annually being, you know, spent on settlements? Imagine what else that money could be spent on. And so that gives them kind of an incentive to get involved. Regarding the basketball players opening the award show up and the WNBA being a catalyst for that, I disagree. I think the catalyst for the WNBA was Jesse Williams, and the catalyst for Jesse Williams was the Black Lives Matter movement. At the core of all of this is those young Black and brown activists that are out there every day who everybody, you know, keeps questioning what do they want, or have they really been effective, or what are their demands, who's putting all this kind of pressure on them to deliver when we can't even see that they are delivering us both a message and delivering us out of a context. The fact that these people, like the basketball players, can get up there and say that, the fact that we can have this level of discourse, the fact that there is this bipartisan support for criminal justice reform, and that there's public will and political pressure to do so, is a result of what's happening on the street. And I don't think the activists often get enough credit for how they've changed the narrative, how they put this issue in the forefront, how they've caused Hollywood, the pundit class, I mean, every area of society to take notice to this. And so it's not always just about, though it's important, but it's not always about what is the legislative agenda of Black Lives Matter, or what are their demands, or what do they want, or who is their leader, or who speaks for them, or who is their spokesperson. What's important is the outcome. And the outcome is that we are having these conversations, but it has to go beyond conversations. Those basketball players that we're referring to haven't, as Roddy said, you know, perfectly summed up, they're still playing it very safe with what they did. What they did opening it up was not truly remarkable, because they haven't sacrificed anything. They didn't put themselves on the line to lose anything. When they are willing to sacrifice, when they're willing, and as Laurent said too, you know, they didn't call for anything that really is germane to the problem, and he's right. When we want to convene this conversation, it gets convoluted, because we want to talk about, oh, we got to appreciate how hard the cop's job is, and, oh, but Black people are killing Black people, and that's why the cops have to be there. You know, if they really wanted to take a sacrifice, if they really wanted to make a power play, they'd say, hey, listen, civilian oversight of the police departments in America is almost non-existent. In a city like Philadelphia, you know, you have a police department that has a budget of $55 million, and the civilian oversight agency has a budget of less than 1% of that. You have other cities who don't have civilian oversight agencies at all. So a real power move would have said, hey, you know, we're basketball players. We know what this problem is. This is resulting from a lack of power, an unequal power dynamic between police and citizens, the fact that citizens don't have the right in real time to defend themselves from police aggression and government tyranny, that citizens aren't reviewing these cases and not on the firearm review board. This is the issue. And so we're not going to play any game until we get a federal agenda how we're going to bolster civilian oversight and fund it in cities. And so if they're not going to sacrifice anything to push a policy agenda or to further the discussion in the way it needs to be, in a non-convoluted way, then they're not doing anything impressive.
Okay, gentlemen, you're firing on all cylinders big time tonight. Next conversation piece, Black Lives Matters in Public Health Too. And this article is interesting in regard to, yes, there's a lot of attention on with the Black Lives Matter movement of Blacks who are being death or succumbing to death in regards to police encounters. But there's also should be attention being put on Blacks who are alive right now in regards to the health system of the United States. So first person on this one is Rodney.
So this is an interesting piece because, you know, briefly before we got on air, I talked about the passing of Dr. Sabi and his work to heal people through natural means, something I've been very enlightened to, I've applied in my life. So I'm a little more emotionally tied to the health issue, the health problems that the Black community faces, having seen it in my own family, My mother passed away at 41. My dad has several issues we're getting him treated for and healed from. My daughter's been through issues, eyes, face health issues. And there's certain things that we really have to – I can go through all the numbers that this article talked about in a very educational way. And I highly recommend people go look at it if you don't understand the disparities of health care, health issues, that every health issue you can think of is more of a problem in the Black community. If you talk about police brutality, that's more of an issue in the Black community. If you think about poverty, that's more of an issue in the Black community. But the one thing that we have somewhat the most control over is what we put into our body, and that's our health. And I really have shifted my thought process on health separated from fitness. And a lot of us, especially Black people, Black men, we are mass miseducated about what to put into our bodies. You know, if we think about our diet from east to west coast, north to south, it is predominantly a slave diet where we still eat the foods that were forced upon us and left upon us that we've turned into cuisine and through tradition we've grown emotionally connected to. And if we just take a back for just a moment, if you look at those people that we derive from and the place that they come from, they don't die from the same diseases we do because they don't eat the things that we do. We talk about heart disease. Then you can throw in there all the drug use and alcohol abuse. But when we talk about epidemics and pandemics, health is killing way too many. Bad health, early heart attacks, strokes, cancers are taking us out in our 30s. I'm in my early mid-30s, and I have people I went to high school with dying of cancer, having double knee replacements. We're not talking about traditionally old people here. We're talking about people in their early to mid-30s, and some of them late 30s, dying from cancer, knee replacements, hip replacements, gallbladder removals, lymphedema, blood cancers, bone cancers, brain cancers, tumors. What in the world is going on that in mass these diseases that used to be rare are everyday occurrence? Everybody listening to the live or rebroadcast of this content, you know somebody. You know somebody who's been through cancer. And if you're Black, you know several people, whether have had cancer, died from cancer, you can throw in their HIV and AIDS. What's going on that we are dying at such an epidemic rate? We have to re-educate ourselves about health. We have to separate ourselves from our emotional, and it's true. I can go around, I can argue anybody to life about this. It's emotional connections to food that allow us, that keep us from making the changes. I'm echoing a little bit, so I apologize. We have to break ourselves from the emotional connection to food and say to the soul of ourselves, I want to live because more than I love XYZ food. And I'll be even more controversial and say and name the two major offenders of what we put into our bodies. Pork and shellfish. If anybody wants to live longer, healthier, listen to the words that I'm saying. Quit the pork and shellfish. And before you talk back to me, realize your reaction is emotional. It's not fact-based. It's not health-based. It's based on your traditions. It's based on your emotions. It's not based on what's best for your health. It's time to live, brothers and sisters. We have to be re-educated, and I highly recommend you research the work of Dr. Sebi, S-E-B-I, so you can start learning about what's going to save your life and prolong the life of those you love, your children, and the generations to come.
Next up, Chris.
Yeah, I'll just say really quick, what I got from the article was the impact of witnessing this violence, this police violence, of consuming the media of it, the nonstop news cycle, the repeated videos of it, how this level of violence and this discourse around it is impacting mental health. I think that it is. It's one reason why I recommend that people do not watch these videos of these police killings. I don't think it's normal for human beings to watch the executions of other human beings. I think we're becoming too desensitized to murder and to violence. We feel like we have to watch it to be informed, and we don't. And then it causes anxiety and depression and paranoia, and people tend to hyperbolize or engage in hyperbole, the facts. And so, you know, everything has to have context. You know, I tell people Philadelphia has a brutal history. Their police department is brutal, and we can't escape that. But it's inaccurate to live in Philadelphia and to consume the news around the world of what's happening, and then, you know, say, you know, I'm against these killer cops, or one of these killer cops off our street, or, you know, we have these racist killer cops in our city. You know, we had 3 people die from officer involved shootings last year. 3. And so it's not a huge epidemic in the city. It's not really a huge epidemic in the country the way we make it sound. A lot of it is hyperbole, but it is an issue. And I think that we're not engaging it with facts. We're engaging with it with a lot of emotion. We're not clear-headed when we talk about it. And the more that we focus and victimize ourselves based on the news cycle, the more our mental health and our sense of security will diminish.
And LaRon.
Okay, well, first off, Chris, man, I want to say thank you. You know, even though you and I, we got off on like a little rocky start with the Trump-Hillary, what you just said was just straight fire. I totally agree with you in a sense that watching these snuff films and sharing them around Facebook, social media, et cetera, it does nothing healthy for the Black psyche and for the Black mental state. You know, watching Black people get killed over and over, I mean, it does not help. And the thing that I'm worried about is that the mental state of our young Black boys in particular that are watching these films. I mean, it's just imagine, I mean, if you are a 12-year-old Black boy, you're coming up, you know, you're in the inner city, or let's just say even the suburbs, wherever in the city of the world, whatever. And you see the police kill Black men, unarmed Black men that are not doing anything, that are just running. I mean, there was a young man that they got killed over the weekend. His name is Paul O'Neill. He was killed in Chicago. And there's a snuff film of that being shared around. And so I tell people, please stop sharing those films. Please do not tag me on those videos. Matter of fact, I wrote a piece for the Good Men Project. It's called Stop Sharing Black Pain. There's so many facets to Black health. I mean, it's the mental anguish that we experience day in and day out, being victims of racism, white supremacy. As Rodney pointed out, there's our diet. The fact that there's so few healthy options in the ghetto. The fact that, you know, we're taught to fry everything. I mean, I think Rodney hit the nail right on the head when he said that a lot of our diet is pretty much slave food. You know, there's so much starch, there's so much grease. You know, the fact that being healthy in the Black community is having a couple pounds on you is we want our women to look thick. I mean, it's going to the gym is not something that is championed. I mean, and it's a shame because, I mean, there's a term that I learned. It's called food desert. And that's what a lot of us are living in right now. I mean, it costs $1.29 to get a McDonald's cheeseburger, right? But it costs more to get greens from the farmer's market. Apples are super expensive. So, I mean, that's It's totally done by design, and I think that due to the lack of healthy food options, we're dying sooner. And also, one thing that I definitely want to bring up, Dr. Vibe, is that the Black community, we have such a reluctance to go to the doctor, because, I mean, the fact that we've never gotten fair medical treatment, but that's another facet of racism, white supremacy. So I say this to say, Black people, let's start cooking our food healthy. Let's start exercising, going for walks, and let's practice self-care. I mean, we're all victims of racism, white supremacy, and that we need to be mentally and emotionally fit to deal with this world. We need to have our mind, our body, and our soul all as one. So I just say, let's just stress self-care, and let's just, you know, let's take care of ourselves so that we're around for our grandkids, for our great-grandkids. And that means putting down the blunt. That means putting down the hard liquor, the soda, and just let's embrace a healthy lifestyle for 2016.
Okay, next conversation piece. Should be an interesting one, but they all are. American Christianity has long struggled to be on the right side of racial justice. First up on this one is Chris.
This was an interesting piece, and I've often, I think it's interesting. I think it really depends on what section or segment of Christianity you're talking about, because I think there is a section of at least the Black church that has always been engaged in social justice and racial justice, and I'm glad that the article mentioned Nat Turner, who, you know, I think is a forgotten civil rights activist. We don't use the term civil rights activist when we talk about people like Nat Turner and Harriet Tubman and Richard Allen, but they absolutely are. Dr. King, Ralph Abernathy, all of those guys were able to do what they were able to do because there was a Richard Allen, because there was a Nat Turner. And Richard Allen was, you know, the founder of Mother Bethel, which is one of the very first Black church in America in Philadelphia. It's still there today. One of my good friends is the pastor there, and that church is leading the movement. It's one of the few churches in the city that Black Lives Matter has a relationship with. But I think in a larger narrative, it's right. Christianity and Christians do not see themselves as social justice warriors. They think that they can fast and pray, and that will be it. They tend to just willfully ignore the parts of the Bible that say, you know, faith without works is dead, and that we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, wickedness, and rulers of the air, and that you are supposed to fight. You are supposed to engage in battle. That you are absolutely supposed to engage in injustice. I tell everyone, you think Jesus would not be a protester? I mean, from what you, if you actually read the type of man he was, he absolutely was an activist. He absolutely did not tolerate corruption or disingenuous. You know, he turned over the temple because of corruption. And we have whitewashed and trivialized and emasculated the image of Jesus, who Jesus Christ was. We made him to simply be this peaceful prophet and not a warrior. And I think we have to, you know, remind ourselves that Jesus, who he was when he manifested as man, if you believe that, was a warrior. He was not somebody who enjoyed simply being a spectator.
Next up, LaRon.
You know, I like this article a lot. I mean, kudos to Dr. Vibe, man. I mean, you know, these pieces have been pretty much on point. You know, I've always been curious as to why now the Christian community has been largely silent in a lot of the protests, a lot of the police terrorism, just a lot of the white supremacy that has just been running rampant. You know, It seems as if, you know, the church, and particularly the Black church, I mean, they just haven't been active, man. I mean, going back to what the gentleman before me said, I mean, Ralph Abernathy, Martin Luther King, I mean, those guys come from the church, which also Nat Turner comes from the church. And those were some pretty revolutionary guys. I mean, let me backtrack. I don't feel comfortable calling Martin Luther King a revolutionary, but those were civil rights activists. And you don't see that same energy, that same fervor coming from the church today. There's a divide, and we spoke about this last week. I mean, a lot of the Black church, they don't really jive with Black Lives Matter and other street protesters because the ideology is different. You know, there was a video that circled recently. There was a civil rights activist named P.K. Boone in Baltimore, and he was telling Jamal Bryant, get out the hood because you're not here when we need you. And Jamal Bryant, he's a pretty prominent black preacher. So I'm disappointed that they have not stepped up. I mean, I'm not surprised at the white Christian community. I mean, I think Rodney said this numerous times, many white Christians are white before they're Christian. So, I mean, I'm not looking to them to help out because, I mean, again, like I just don't think that we are going to get liberation from anyone other than ourselves. It's just sad that the black community, particularly the black church, has not been very vocal. You know what I mean? A lot of it could be because Christianity, it's built on being passive. And a lot of young folks are just like, hey, man, you know, I'm not about to get my head beat in like John Lewis did and not do nothing back. Those days are over. So it's going to be up to the young people that are in the church to build community, to build alliances with the people that are out in the streets. I know that a church that I attend, Glide Church in San Francisco, they are big on social justice. And so as a sort of a activist myself, I can build with people from that church that are not willing to get their hands dirty. But there's not enough people from the church to do that, and that's the sad part, man. And you know, we could blame that on the fact that Christianity has really, all BS aside, has been was forced on black people to make black people passive and to make them subjugated, or maybe people as Chris said, maybe people don't realize that faith without work doesn't get you anywhere. You know, you gotta put some action behind your prayer. So that's all I have.
Okay, and final on this one goes to Rodney.
The truth shall make you free. There's two different translations of that scripture. One says the truth shall set you free. And the one that I prefer is the one that says the truth shall make you free. And the difference is when you're made free is you're being made from a prison you don't know you're in. One of the DNC speakers, I applaud what he said because he spoke the truth that if the people listen will make them free. He said, Jesus, a brown-skinned Palestinian Jew, it flies in the face of the mass miseducated version of white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus that's enforced upon the masses after the institution of slavery was enacted. As a Christian who's a black man, I understand fully that the scripture says, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all the things will be added unto you. Seek ye first. But what I see predominantly in with white Christianity, predominantly, not all, but predominantly, is that they seek first their whiteness before they seek the Christianity, seek the kingdom of God. And for too long, in this country, on this side of the Atlantic, that's how Christianity has been shaped, not who Christ is. And people, you know, not knowingly, look at how Christians act and paint the picture of Christ. And sadly, for too many centuries, we've been mass miseducated about who Christ is. We've been mass miseducated about what slavery is, not was, is, and how it affects people to this day. And I know for a fact that brothers from the past have been crying and making this biblical cry to our white counterparts to deaf ears. They've been making the moral cry as human beings to deaf ears to our Christian white counterparts. And I'm saying this knowing that you have white listeners, Dr. Vibe, and you have white readers, Dr. Vibe, and for once I'm going to speak to them for a moment, is that if you look at the Bible, not what a man told you, not what a picture in a church told you, whatever denomination it may be, If you read what the Bible says, that controversial statement is truth that'll make you free, a brown-skinned Palestinian Jew. If you can say, well, maybe that's true, then you can see how repainting the face of Christ and forcing, yes, and I'm still a Christian, knowing that, yes, some and a lot of slaves were beat and forced into Christianity, has shaped the way black people traditionally have practiced Christianity under the same false view of Christ, has been very damaging and epidemically genocidal, because it allows us to not see the value of ourselves. We believe God looks like somebody who's oppressing us. The truth shall make you free. If you look at the truth of who Christ is, if you're a believer in Christ, if you're a follower in Christ, how dare you put your whiteness first before the kingdom of God and the work that we're supposed to do? I'm making this call as a Christian minister. I'm making this call of a Christian minister who happens to be a black man, who happens to take the time to study to show myself approved and look at what the facts about history and what's at stake. If you haven't opened your eyes that people are dying in mass because of lies, because of fear, which God did not give us the spirit of fear, but one of power, love, and of a sound mind. And I might have a sermon now, so I'm going to pull back for a little bit, let go of these reins, and leave people with one more fact. But there's a permissive will of God and a perfect will of God. The perfect will of God is you to love your neighbor as you love yourself. Every single one of those neighbors that may be brown skin, white skin, transparent, they may be yellow, whatever they may be, commanded to love. You are commanded to love them as you love yourself. And if you were to do that, despite all your other traditions, all your other miseducation, your mass miseducation, maybe we can really start having some conversations. And so, my black brothers and sisters, continue to show yourself approved. Continue to show the love of Christ, but do it in a way that shows the truth that'll make people free. And that's what Christ did at the price of his life. So therefore, we are commanded to do so. We have to do and follow his example. It cost us, but it cost Christ more.
Okay, and final conversation piece of the night. A very interesting article, Open Letter to White People Who Are Obsessed with Black-on-Black Crime. We'll go first on this one to LaRon. Sorry.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Bob. You know, whenever white people bring up what about black-on-black crime, I mean, to me, that's just sort of a deflection. Well, not sort of. It actually is a deflection. I mean, from what I know, sorry about that. Black on black crime is a term that was invented in the 80s or 80s or not like late 80s, early 90s, sort of around the crack epidemic and the epidemic and the rise of gangbanging. You know, I mean, whenever people say, well, what about black on black crime? To me, that's an automatic. You are a racist white supremacist, because police terrorism and black-on-black crime, those are two totally different issues, right? For starters, you're going to put a street thug on the same level as a police officer who was sworn to serve and protect, who was sworn to be non-biased, and I know that that's very funny, and who was sworn to be a trustworthy and balanced individual. The fact that this person that is committing crimes, he's a criminal, he and the cop, I mean, they're two totally different individuals. So that's with that argument. Secondly, there's no such thing as black on black crime. For some reason, black people were always super stigmatized and just a target of just rampant criminality, as if that is a pathology of being black in America. Studies show, and you can look this up, that black people commit crimes at the same amount as whites commit crimes. It's the same amount as Latinos commit crimes. People that live in the same area will commit crimes against each other because they live in the same area. you know, whenever people bring up the black on black crime thing, they don't want to address the fact that we live in a system of racism, white supremacy, the fact that this system has disenfranchised and just essentially put blacks at a lower class than whites. You know, we don't want to talk about how the police are essentially an arm of racism, white supremacy. You know, Dr. Joy DeGroote said that the reason why whites don't like to talk about things such as racism, such as slavery, is because when we do that, we have to pull back the covers of America, and that will show all the scars to be visible. So, I mean, it's a very easy argument to debunk. I mean, it's for some reason, man, like black on black crime, the race card. I mean, it's just things to just deflect from the fact that most whites on a daily basis practice racism against other non-white people, and they don't want to be held accountable for the things that their people in the past have done to create this system to disenfranchise and to disparage and to harm non-white people. So, I mean, just the black on black crime argument is, it's idiotic and it can be easily debunked. So thank you.
Next up, Chris.
I'll keep it short. It's getting late. I wrote an article about black on black crime, about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago. You know, one of the writers at TechBook is a criminal justice professor at Temple University and a second year PhD student in the criminal justice program. And so we look at this issue of violence and justice and race in a lot of different ways. And one of the things that we understand is that black on black crime is an unfortunate term that further criminalizes and creates this image of criminality for black skin. The reality is you don't even feel comfortable saying Latino on Latino crime or Chinese on Chinese crime or Indian on, I mean, we don't even have a language or a lexicon that accommodates that. It's exclusively used for black people. It's an incredibly racist term. It's unfortunate how black people have just started to repeat the script and degrade themselves with that term. What I understand to be the case is as Laurent alluded to moments ago, it's intra-racial violence is what we're talking about. Of every race, people are killed by people in the same race. It's called intra-racial violence, not black-on-black crime. Intra-racial violence. Within the race, people commit crimes. And that's because of segregation. I mean, we still live in very much segregated cities, segregated neighborhoods. We go to segregated churches. We have black churches. We have white churches. We have black praise and worship. We have white praise and worship. We have different record labels for those types of music. So, I mean, and that is the issue. You know, the latest statistics on black-on-black crime show that black people kill other black people at 90% of the time, and white people kill other white people 83% of the time. It's relatively the same in mid-80s to high 80s, high 90s for any racial group. And so it is a misdirection when people bring it up relating to police violence. It's actually offensive, right? Because I think it insults your intelligence. When you're trying to have a really nuanced conversation about power and authority and class and race and misperception, and someone says, well, what about black and black crime? And I go, well, what about it? I mean, what does that have to do with anything? You know what I mean? And people don't know how to have this conversation about policing and power and race. And so they want to throw that in there because that seems like the ultimate default. And really it's victim blaming. It says, you know, you can't complain about anything in your neighborhood until you stop people from killing other people in your neighborhood. You don't have the right to be upset about state-sponsored violence, or you don't have the right to be upset about where your taxpayer dollars are going because you guys can't stop killing yourselves. So that's why we have to occupy your neighborhoods with police. That's why black people are stopped more than white people by stop and frisk. That's why the racial disparities are that, because black people are committing more crimes. Well, that's not true. And then that causes the question, well, what are we talking about when we say crime? when we say black people commit the most crimes, what kind of crimes are we talking about? Because the majority of violent crimes are committed by white people. The majority of mass shootings are committed by white people. The majority of rape, particularly incest rape, is committed by white people. So the majority of insider stock trading is committed by white people. And so I don't know what major crime organizations black people have, but if we really want to talk about crime, let's talk about white crime.
And to close off this edition of Do You Know What Time It Is, Rodney Kellum.
So I tend to take a little bit of a different view on a lot of these issues. And I love the letter. The letter was, you know, I found it funny, but funny truthful. It's funny because it's true. And he was just speaking the truth that a lot of black people feel when they hear a white person say, but what about, you know, it's like, oh, here we go again. But I just want to take a slightly different view about this issue about crime. And specifically, murders is really what's going around the news cycle, where we see black people dying at the hands of black people dying at the hands of police, brown people dying at the hands of brown people, black people dying at the hands of police, white people dying at the hands of white people dying at the hands of police. The root of this is what I want to talk about. And I truly believe in mass, we're having the wrong conversation because I believe Iran alluded and Flood alluded to this. We become so desensitized to something as extreme as taking another person's life is that we can talk about murder and say, but. Meaning someone's child, someone's father, brother, cousin, sister, auntie, uncle, friend, will never breathe another breath on this earth again, and you say, but. Someone's life was cut short. They'll never get to see their children grow up. They may never get to have children. They may never get to be a positive influence in somebody's life. And you say, but. There is a deep moral problem and spiritual problem with what's happening to people is when we can talk about mass murder. Mass murder and say, but what's happened to us as human beings is when we can talk about human life as if it doesn't have more value than animals. The tiger incident or the lion incident, Cecil the Lion, I believe his name was killed by a dentist. And there was a massive uproar calling for his license and punishment for this man and righteous indignation. And yet, and still, we can see a four-year-old girl in the backseat of a car watching the male figure in her life die from gunshots through a chest. And we say, but. I call every person who can hear me is to reexamine what's going on in your spirit, in your soul, in your mind that allows you to have the wrong conversations. And interjecting the word but when we talk about the loss of a human life. And so please stop being obsessed with black-on-black crime. Please stop being obsessed with crime and start getting obsessed with why you're okay with it.
That is another edition of Do You Know What Time It Is on most Sunday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, where black men give comments, opinions, and thoughts on current events and current news stories. I'd like to thank all the gentlemen for hitting it out of the park tonight. And before we let them leave, we'll have them give their contact information. First up, Chris Flood, the drummer, Norris.
Well, thanks for welcoming me back, Doc. It was a pleasure. It was a great conversation, great topics that we discussed. People can follow me on Twitter at Flood the Drummer, LoodTheDrummer. I'm also on Facebook.com/Flood the Drummer for all of my iPad, iPhone users out there. If you get your content on Apple News, if you've got a little pink newspaper app on your home screen, add TechBook Online to your channel so that you can read our original stories of impact issue, inspiration, and innovation. Most Friday evenings, you can catch me on 900 AM WURD or 900AMWURD.com. reliving the week that was. And last thing I'll say is visit textbookonline.com and download volume 2, edition 3 of Tabs. That's volume 2, edition 3 of Tabs at textbookonline.com.
Excellent. Next up, Laron Barton.
Okay, you can reach me, Laron Barton, on Twitter at Mainline Laron. That's MAINLINELERON. You can also find me on Facebook. I have a Facebook writing page. It's under Laron L. Barton. And you can also hit me on my website. It's www.mainlinepub.com. And also email me at info@mainlinepub.com. As always, my newest piece called Using Uber While Black is on thegoodmenproject.com. So please check that out. And I'm always looking to have conversations with people and just build and share ideas. And thank you very much, Dr. Bob. Take care.
And finally, Rodney Kellum.
I'd like to end the same way I like to begin, by saying thank you to Dr. Bob for providing an outlet for Black men to talk about things that matter to us and those that love us. If you'd like to reach out to me, engage in a conversation, some of these topics or other topics, you may email me at fatherpreneurship@gmail.com. You may always also check out my blog with wonderful interviews at fatherpreneurship.com, and reach me on all social media platforms, almost all, at fatherpreneur. Love to engage in conversation. Hopefully sow some seeds that'll help speak life into you and maybe help you change some views, or maybe I need to change some views. I'm always open for conversation.
Excellent. Again, thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you very much to the live audience and also the audience that will be listening on the replay. I am Dr. Vibe. Best way to get a hold of me, there are a few. Twitter at drvibeshow. Email address drvibe@thedrvibeshow.com. And always, you can go to the website also, www.thedrvibeshow.com. Too many things to remember. You can catch me at the Good Men Project. New conversations put up every Tuesday at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can catch me 9 o'clock on Saturday mornings Eastern Time on WJMS Radio hosting. We do replays of Dr. Vibe conversations. And then on the last Saturday of each month, you can catch a live conversation with myself, Jonathan Shaw from the Brampton area of Toronto, and also Henri Morris from the Left Coast. We do a conversation called Black Men Talking. You can catch many of my conversations too on blab.im. I think I may have left one or two things out, but hey, who knows? I'm sure some way, somehow you'll find them out. As always, I'd like to say you're blessed and highly favored. You're a magnet for miracles and your solution for someone's problem. God bless. Peace be well. Keep the faith. And as always, walk good.